The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the September issue of Our State Magazine, featuring articles around this month's theme, The Sounds of Home. And we will start out with the lead article entitled, The Sounds of Home. From ocean breezes to mountain winds, whistles to fiddles, a music rooted in place and memory travels across North Carolina. And looking at the photos here, an Appalachian breeze, rustling leaves at daybreak, and a bagpiper's haunting strains combine to form sound that is all our own. And we do have that picture of, looks like goldenrod, and the sunrise at daybreak over the mountains. And you see the blue, why they call it the Blue Mountains, the Blue Ridge Mountains, that they're the blue dusk, fog. And then we have, to our on the right page, we have a bagpiper on full regalia. From Poplar Branch to Owl Creek, from Lockwood's Folly and Brasstown, I hear North Carolina sounding. As some of our state's sounds become almost tunes or even songs, the gift to us is, in a sense, a choral library of wide-ranging, never-stopping sonic wonders. Music from both the nature around us and the efforts of our humanity. A Carolina chorale. From sea to mountain, one hears unmatched sonic bookends. Ocean breezes may make the flag flying high over Frying Pan Tower, 32 miles off Cape Fear, rumble and flap. No less than that flag briskly snapping in the strong winds, coursing over Mount Mitchell, well over a mile higher and some 300 miles west. The screeches and heavy knocks in the train yards from coastal Morehead City or Sand Hills Hamlet may later be echoed back by the metal-on-metal squealing of a Western Carolina engine slowly dragging its boxcars up the long, looping grade just west of Old Fort, climbing the high side of the Blue Ridge to go up and over and finally through the Swannanoa Tunnel at Ridgecrest, of which Bascom Lamar Lunsford once sang. Thomas Wolfe, who rode these loops to greater glory and who revered and remembered their sounds as their engines and boxcars and club cars went rolling on, wrote memorably of them, how they rattle, how they howl, how they roar and roar on, and how they wail back at their ghostly cries. A fiddler in Ocracoke and another in Brasstown may both light out in the old tune Over the Waterfall, their rosined bows cutting and squalling over their respective strings, distant, but both ringing out in the key of D. Why, one evening 30 years ago, I heard two elementary school choirs, one in a Cherokee classroom and one at First Flight Elementary School in Killdevil Hills, singing together in the same virtual moment in both English and Cherokee, led by a conductor standing in the North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh, and their song, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. On a bright June day, afloat in good, tight lines, company miles out in the Atlantic off Bogue and Shackelford Banks, waiting for the amberjack to stripe, a deep, bluesy moan put a spell on me. Nothing in those moments could have surprised me more, yet what it was, sending that low, flattened third melody my way in a mimic of the slow lowing of a lone calf. Such blue notes every few seconds, way out there on the briny deep. Those notes were words of warning, emanating from the watery tube of a tall red and white whistle buoy, floating and bobbing several miles out from Beaufort Inlet, suspended at the far end of the shipping channel, held in place by a long anchor chain, forever there to moan, and in moaning, to warn sailors and fishermen of dangers they might face when they go out to the sea. What could be more touching and meaningful than this? A machine only, the buoy was, though it sounds surely, a machine only the buoy was, though it sounds surely had a musical soul. A saxophone is a built chamber, and a fiddle is a designed box. though the former wants a John Coltrane to make it laugh or cry like a human voice, and the latter needs a Tommy Jarrell to help it penetrate the heart with its slender, insistent notes. This whistle buoy could bring to the ears and to the heart a cry like that of someone deeply seeking mercy in a desert place in the darkest hour of night, or the hurt of pure loneliness itself without any answer at all. And yet the sea, and only the sea, played those sounds and made them known. Not every jackhammer, pile driver, and grating noise is a musical sound, though we value highly the bridges and byways and fishing piers that those rhythm makers build for us. But many of the motions and waves that we and vast nature itself set loose moving in the Carolina air come to our ears both as individual sounds and sometimes as surprising aural collaborations. Have you been driving or walking with me on an early autumn evening along Morrow Mill Road in the central Piedmont community of Clover Garden? Not all that many years ago, you would have heard this special triple helix of Carolina agrarian sounds. A soybean combine racketeously cutting beans, pulled by an old vet, old yet vigorous huffing John Deere tractor, and the neighbor farmer Clayton Rogers standing up at the wheel, his heavens-bound center singing hymns over it all. This agrarian marriage of machinery and music made for a duo of metallic rhythms backing up the melodic power of Clayton's Amazing Grace and How Great Thou Art as he ran his tractor and sang in praise. And glory be, too, for the hit-and-miss engines one hears at the old-time gatherings in Waynesville and Carthage and Denton or Horn Creek Farm near the Yadkin Valley. The breathy huh and the light clicking pops of the small threshing machines. And, too, the furious high RPM whining of the speedboats at the International Cup Regatta on the Passportank River long ago. Their rooster tail wakes going 50 feet or more into the air and raining down on the water with a hard splattering that children could hear and cheer from the riverside. And for the sounds Earl Scruggs' three fingers made, like no one before him ever had, crawling on his banjo strings and knocking out Foggy Mountain Breakdown, while a trucker hears him on the all-night radio as his tractor trailer lays out an anxious gear-grinding melody as it slowly screeches down the misty grade of the Blue Ridge from Fancy Gap to Mount Airy. Maybe stock car king Junior Johnson hears old Earl, too, while he guns the engine of his yellow Ford and lets it sing along in its own original voice, as Tom Wolfe heard it years ago. And in the western Piedmont, for the gas burners firing and breathing, their heated exhalations filling the big multicolored balloons with enough hot air to put them in great company high in the air and move them around like the wispy seeds of a dandelion. And for more flight in the mountains, the sharp, quick-singing zing of zip lines slicing through the forests or down the mountainsides, as at Lake Eden in the old Black Mountain College, delighting and delivering youngsters into the spring and summertime waters of the lake. And for a man at first light on a spring morning, singing a melodic cooing to lure his dairy cattle from a stream woods bottom up to his milking parlor. And for hickory coals falling and settling from wood stove and fire barrels at an all-night barbecue pit, at the dawn of which, after all that holy smoke cooking, the bowie and butcher knives alike in their bright chopping rhythms, thwacking cutting boards, worked the pork down to size, much like the chop, slice, and crack of the maul when we're splitting wood in the fall. And the avid whooshing in a wood stove as a fire catches and gets going, the hissing of a backlog, the crackling of others building around it. And for the other sweet soughing of the wind in the pines, later the ticking and clicking of sleet and hail and freezing rain against our roofs and windows. For the ice falling down from high oaks on a warming winter's day down onto the hollies below and hitting those hard green leaves with a sound like shot. And for the cooing of doves, and for the shriek of the raven high above the New River in Allegheny County, and for the barred owls hooting at each other on the night of April's full pink moon over a beech tree ridge above Merchant's Mill Pond, and for the hound dog's howl and the bobcat's cry, and for that old Alamance lady who swore she could not get a proper sleep until she got out to the family's cabin in Stony Creek and heard the flying squirrels smack the steep tin roof and slide down, the nails on their little paws scratching that tin, trying to get a hold. Glory be for the coveys of quail, when we were lucky enough to hear them announce themselves as Bob White and the Nightjar's Whippoorwill and Chuck Will's Widow, their big whistles at dusky dark as they cry out spring's beginnings and beyond, for a few relic mill whistles that yet abide, like the one in Beaufort, a replica of a one-time lumber mill shift changer now adopted by a mill whistle brewery, its deep, breathy thrust precisely at 7:47 p.m., casting itself all across town, and another, the one in Canton, formerly of the paper mill, set on the Pisgah Memorial Stadium scoreboard in 2023 and ready to sound off for the high school homecoming game before Hurricane Helene struck in the waning days of late September. And for the deep East Lake Mythic steam whistle down in Dare County, too, that was said to have once called lumber folk turned illegal distillers to work at a factory still near Buffalo City 100 years ago, the law being bought and paid for and giving the enterprise no mind. And for one of the most original and promising events I know of from recent times, on a foggy afternoon this past January, Beaufort photographer and musician Scott Taylor suited up his Highland kilt and regalia and strode the short distance from his home to a Taylor's Creek dock, tuned up, and began playing his bagpipes in the clouds of fog. In such moments, one may think he was playing only for himself, as Scott thought, and so thought his wife, musician and artist Lenore Meadows, watching and listening 100 feet away. Yet Lenore spied a pod of dolphins swimming east down Taylor's Creek toward the wide mouth of the North River and the feeding grounds of Back Sound and Middle Marshes. She saw the dolphins, when just past Scott, slow down and dive. She caught the moment when one of them surfaced at Scott's feet to check him out and to hear his fiercely Scottish version of Amazing Grace, a phenomenal moment of transcendent sonic across currency that may never have occurred before. Pure magic in our Carolina province, if magic exists at all. Glory be for these soundings, each and every last Carolina one of them. Our next in the theme of Sounds of Home is entitled Ripe for the Pickin'. Come and listen to a story about a man named Earl who changed the sound of bluegrass forever, one three-finger roll at a time. The boy spent his rare moments of idle time on his family's 40-acre farm traipsing through the garden behind his mama's house. Skipping amid tomato and okra plants, he'd spot patches of crabgrass, snatch up one of the long jointed stems, put one end in his teeth, and pull the other end taut. When he plucked it with his right hand, its reedy twang sounded to him like nature's symphony. Earl Scruggs heard music in everything around him, the percussive patter of the plow handle that he gripped while tilling cotton fields, the rat-a-tat-tat of hooves clomping on hard ground as he rode a mule-drawn buggy from the family home in Flint Hill, just southwest of Shelby, to nearby Boiling Springs, the rhythm in the rumble of a motor car whizzing by, perfectly synchronized with the hum that the tires made as their treads connected with grooves in the road. In other words, it was difficult for me to keep my mind on the chores I was into, the pioneering banjo player wrote many years later in his private journals. Anything that would make a sound as a musical tone was experimented with. The tin top of a snuff can, the edge of a knife, a stiff seam in his overalls, the dial on a rotary telephone. "Give me a job to do," he wrote, "and I would still find something to pick on." One stormy morning, I'm navigating the twists and turns of Maple Springs Church Road in southwest Cleveland County, searching for the sounds that fired Scruggs' imagination. Thick pockets of dense white mist blanket the valleys, creating dangerously low visibility. As I drive, a pair of classic songs by Flatten Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys blare from my speakers. Flint Hill Special in their most famous tune, Foggy Mountain Breakdown. The latter instrumental providing the soundtrack for the nail-biting chase scenes in the 1967 film Bonnie and Clyde. Cruising along this rural roller coaster, I feel the inspiration in Scruggs picking the turn of his banjo tuner throughout the Flint Hill special sonically mimics the sharp bends in the road. The steady churn of Foggy Mountain Breakdown simulates the straightaways as my car tops a hill, nearly lifts it off the ground, then dips down again into the foggy valley. Just before the turnoff to Riverside Road, past sprawling farmland, sits a house with a green roof. This is where Earl Eugene Scruggs was born on January 6, 1924. About a half mile down Riverside, I pull into the gravel driveway of a smaller house. This is where Scruggs lived from about age 7 to 17. His grandfather owned much of the land in this farming community, and young Scruggs was intimately familiar with every house and barn, every field and patch of woods, every creek and river. It's pretty much all Scruggs knew until he left Cleveland County 4 years later for Nashville, where along with the mandolin player Bill Monroe, he'd set the template for the lightning speed banjo picking that defines the sound of bluegrass music. I've come to his childhood home to meet with Mary Beth Martin and Zachary Dressel, executive and assistant directors respectively of the Earl Scruggs Center in nearby Shelby. We briefly huddle on the front porch as the hard rain batters the rusted tin roof. It sounds like the steady white noise of the machines that Scruggs heard inside Shelby's Lily Mill, where he worked as a teenager for 40 cents an hour. Inside the house, a massive brick fireplace is the centerpiece of a dark front room. "Right there," Martin says, pointing to a spot in front of the fireplace, "that's where Earl, as a child, learned to play the three-finger style of banjo picking that he'd become famous for." I think back to the first time I heard Scruggs play live at the 1976 festival in Galax, Virginia, as part of the Earl Scruggs Review with his sons, Gary and Randy. I think back to the hazy days of my childhood, stretched out on the couch in my family's front room, watching the Beverly Hillbillies and singing along to the show's banjo-fueled theme song recorded by Flat and Scruggs. I think back to those chase scenes in Bonnie and Clyde, the reeling and churning of Flat and Scruggs' banjo, guitar, and fiddle as the notorious Barrow Gangs careens down dirt roads, their 1934 sedan fishtailing around curves as they try to escape the police. This is where it all started. Right here in this room, this is where the sounds that Scruggs heard on the farm and in his head transformed into one of America's most recognizable original musical forms. Banjo pickers in this part of North Carolina had long been experimenting with ways to adapt the African-derived rhythm instrument to old-time mountain music. Snuffy Jenkins, born just 17 miles west of the Scruggs' farm, was one of the earliest progenitors of the three-finger picking style. But it was Scruggs who perfected the technique, learning to make sounds with his fingers that no one had ever heard before. It became known as the Scruggs style and was copied by nearly every subsequent bluegrass banjo player. In the mythology of American music, bluegrass was invented by Bill Monroe, who in 1938 named his band the Bluegrass Boys in honor of his home state of Kentucky. His distinctive high-pitched tenor voice and the blend of black and white musical styles, country gospel, Scots-Irish folk, blues, and African-American spirituals set the group apart from other hillbilly bands. But bluegrass is a distinct genre likely would not have existed had Scruggs not joined Monroe's band in 1945. What this 21-year-old from the foothills of North Carolina brought to the mix was a wholly original banjo style. His breakneck picking gave the band's music a sharper, more muscular, and urgent sound, a contrast to the comparatively laid-back fiddle sawing and clamor-haw-style banjo strumming of the typical string ensembles of the day. Scruggs' rolling three-finger style on bluegrass boys' recordings like Heavy Traffic Ahead, Molly and Ten Brooks, and Bluegrass Breakdown did for old-time Appalachian banjo what Jimi Hendrix's squalling licks would later do for rock and roll guitar. Without having to plug into an amplifier, Scruggs' fiery solos electrified the band. Scruggs only lasted 2 years with Monroe before he and guitarist Lester Flatt set out on their own. In 1949, the duo recorded Foggy Mountain Breakdown as a single and hit the road. building their reputation by playing local events and doing live radio appearances across the South. While on tour, Scruggs grew nostalgic whenever the duo found themselves traveling through North Carolina. When his bus tour was coming through this area, Martin says, standing next to a window in the front room of the old house, he'd sometimes drive by here just to look at the home place. Throughout the 50s and 60s, Flatt and Scruggs were so forward-thinking in their approach to old-time music that younger rock musicians took note. Bands like the Byrds and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band had started to experiment with country and bluegrass, and the energy and edginess of Flatt and Scruggs' sound appealed to them. But in 1969, in the thick of the duo's most successful years, Flatt and Scruggs parted ways. Flatt, always more of a traditionalist at heart, wasn't happy with the direction their music was taking and chose to go solo. Scruggs, hungry to keep experimenting with new sounds, formed the Earl Scruggs Review with two of his rock-loving sons, then 20 and 16. One of the biggest thrills a person will ever get to do is go on stage with his children, he told NPR many years later, adding that his sons knew younger people's material. Scruggs continued listening for new sounds and collaborating with younger musicians well into the 21st century. And on September 13, 2006, he got the opportunity to watch and listen to hundreds of those musicians honor him before an Atlanta Braves game. 239 banjo players from around the world, each heavily influenced by the Scruggs style, gathered at Turner Field to perform Foggy Mountain Breakdown in unison. It was a twang the likes of which Scruggs had never heard before. During the tribute, a camera zoomed in on the 82-year-old as he smiled bashfully and waved. The hundreds of banjos performing his most famous tune earned a Guinness World Record for the largest musical instrument ensemble. A handful of years later, the Travis Book of Progressive Bluegrass Band, the infamous String Dusters, saw Scruggs play one of his final gigs before his death in 2012 at age 88. As he listened, Book's mind drifted back to all the different sounds Scruggs had introduced to American music over the previous six decades. He was awed by the musician's never-ending innovation, and even in the face of pushback from old-time music purists. It was not necessarily the easiest career path for him to take, Book said in a WNCW radio documentary about Scruggs. Any artist that continues to sort of push and progress, especially after these really distinct moments of success like he'd had, I thought that was really cool and very inspiring and very brave. I feel like I learned a lot watching that show about what it means to be fearless and to follow the sound that you hear in your head. Driving away from Scruggs' old home place, the rain tapers down and the clouds dissipate, replaced by sunshine and blue sky. The fields look greener now, richer and full of life. I think of something Scruggs said in 1996 after being honored with a State Heritage Award. My music came up from the soil of North Carolina. The words reverberate in my head as I cruise into Shelby's downtown, where a mural of the musician covers an exterior wall at Newgrass Brewing Company. A block and a half up Lafayette Street stands the old Cleveland County Courthouse, transformed in 2014 into the 10,000-square-foot Earl Scruggs Center. The museum traces the banjo pioneer's life from his humble beginnings to his superstardom to his twilight years. Dressel, who curates the museum, opens to the pages in Scruggs' journal where he had jotted down memories of those sounds he heard growing up. As a farm kid, plucking on that blade of grass. As a teen, hearing the hum of the spinning, twisting, spooling, and reeling fibers into yarn at Eulalie Mills. In his 20s, jamming with friends in Shelby and weighing whether or not he could afford to leave his family and enter show business professionally. But a single scribbled line with a misspelling pops out at me as if it's highlighted in bright yellow. It suggests that the course of Scruggs' life was inevitable, that his fate had been sealed from day one. Analyzing my life, I suppose one way I could describe it, he wrote, I was born addicted to picking. And the Earl Scruggs Center is located on South Lafayette Street in Shelby, and you can look up their website at earlscruggscenter.org. I'll close out this episode with one of the regular sections, one of the new sections entitled Welcome to Our State. And I'm going to describe this picture and see if you can guess where we are. Our biggest city reflects off the Firebird. The mirrored sculpture by Nikki de Saint Fail guards the entrance to a building that is itself a work of art. And it's an oval or a standing sculpture that's all mosaic and silvery. If you guess the Beckler Museum of Modern Art in Charlotte, you are correct. Thousands of mid-20th century works fill three floors in this vibrant uptown Charlotte art museum, which was designed by Swiss architect Mario Boda as a place of contemplation. The museum's permanent collection was built upon the personal acquisitions of Swiss art lovers Bessie and Hans Beckler, who began gathering mid-century European and American art in the 1950s. The pair eventually came to own the works of masters and pioneers like Pablo Picasso, Andy Warhol, Bridget Riley, and many more. Today, the Beckler's Trove, which their son Andreas, a Charlottean, and his family gifted to the museum, is displayed alongside rotating exhibitions featuring artists from around the world. The Beckler Museum of Modern Art is located at 420 South Tryon Street in Charlotte, North Carolina, in uptown Charlotte. And you can look up their website at beckler.org. I'll spell that B like Bravo, E, C like Charlie, H, T like Tango, L-E-R.org. And they show a couple of interesting pictures here. The Beckler's collection includes Sol DeWitt's wall drawing, $9.95, Germaine Rickler's La Sautière, The Grasshopper, and rotating pieces from modern artists. And that the statue that's out front, in front of the Beckler, is the Firebird. It actually has, it's like a an archway, and then the bird itself is perched on the archway, and you can see the black mosaic of the toes of the bird, and widespread wings with a sun on the chest of the bird, widespread wings that are also silvery and mosaic, mirrored type tiles, and then its head is has points like a sun, so I think it's, or maybe representative fire for the Firebird, makes sense. And it's actually quite interesting in the sunlight to see it reflecting so. I think we've got time for one quiz section under Book Smarts. From mountain poets to coastal novelists, generations of writers have found their voices in North Carolina. See if you can guess from the choices which Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and biographer lived with his wife on a goat farm near Flat Rock from 1945 until his death in 1967. Was it Carl Sandburg, James Dickey, or E.E. Cummings? If you guessed Carl Sandburg, you would be correct. Well, that means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long until next time.